quick introduction to today's episode with my guest, Dr. Andy Galpin. Andy Galpin is one of my go-to people when it comes to exercise physiology. Ironically, we actually didn't talk that much about muscle or exercise physiology in today's podcast because we went down and started talking about all different types of topics around fat loss, performance, fitness technology, etc. But one of the ways I came across Andy first was on his podcast last year with Joe Rogan. It was one of my favorite Joe Rogan podcasts of last year. And I kind of went down the Dr. Andy Galpin rabbit hole after that because I got so much value from that particular episode. I started consuming his content and he puts up amazing videos on exercise physiology on his YouTube. Now, they're very hardcore on the science. So if you geek out on science and exercise physiology like me, then you will 100% love it and I highly recommend it. But today's podcast, we use a little bit more modern terms discussing things. Now, we get heavy into the science at times, but it's broken down really well. One of the things I love about Dr. Andy is his ability to give you different perspectives and contextualize ideas based on why this works for one demographic and why it doesn't for others. And the ones we kind of focused on today are on the two ends of the spectrum. So weight loss and fat loss and high end, performance for, say, athletes, GA players, rugby players, soccer players, so athletes in general. Because of the amount of professional fighters and athletes that Andy works with, he's highly specialized in the field of high performance with those athletes, with their sports nutrition and their actual exercise and training programs. And what I tried to do in today's episode was bring the fat loss, weight loss, body composition angle from it and then kind of merge it in between. So today's episode jumps between those two parameters. So if weight loss is your goal, body composition is your goal, fat loss is your goal, then you're going to love this episode. If you play a sport, a GA player, soccer player, anyone in a glycolic-based sport, i.e. a carbohydrate sprint-based sport, you're going to get so much value from this. Some of the things we talked about, the difference between how you should eat for fat loss versus for performance, not demonizing fruit, and even if fat loss is your goal, how to incorporate carbohydrate and fruit into your diet. The problem with keto as a long-term strategy for GEA players in particular, just because of my own kind of bias there, I asked Andy about his thoughts on keto and how actually as a short-term strategy, he doesn't mind it for, say, hurlers, footballers, etc. But as a long-term strategy, it's one of the worst things they can do. We also focused heavily on post-workout nutrition, because this is something that's been coming in quite a lot on my Instagram story Q&As. So my 10 question story Q&As Monday to Friday on Instagram, I've been asked a lot about post and pre-workout nutrition to a degree. And Andy's answer on this is so valuable in the context of weight loss, where he speaks about how it actually doesn't matter as much and how the literature and most recent science shows that it's your overall caloric in output or your overall caloric intake, meaning the amount of calories you take in. So when you hear caloric input or the amount of calories you eat, that's what we're talking about and how that's the most important thing when weight loss or fat loss is your goal. But when you're an athlete or somebody who's training at a high intensity or you're trying to put on muscle mass, it's a completely different story. We also spoke about challenging sleep with strategic sleep deprivation, which is really interesting because in last week's podcast, I had Cristiano, or one of the coaches for Cristiano Ronaldo, who plays for Juventus, one of the top soccer players, arguably one of the best of all time. And Nick Littlehales worked a lot with Cristiano Ronaldo, and he had a similar strategy towards challenging your sleep. And there's a little bit of a segue into what Andy was speaking about on today's podcast with challenging sleep, with strategic sleep deprivation, and then paying it back on the back end, where you work for sleep deprivation on the front end, and then you pay it back on the back end. Very similar to fasting, where you strategically don't eat for a certain period of time, and then you load up your calories during your actual eating window, if you're doing some form of time-restricted eating protocol. We spoke about the rule of three, which is a mindset. Well, I didn't expect to go down this area with Andy, where he speaks about calming yourself down, emotional states, dealing with shit online, dealing with people being annoying or just being a dick. He speaks about using his rule of three, which is really valuable. And then the last thing was gamification and overusing fitness technology and how it can actually hinder your performance. That being said, he also argued who fitness technology, i.e. watches, apps, etc., can benefit, but how for a certain type of person, it's the worst thing they can do for their long-term performance. So this is a really wide-ranging conversation in the space of sports nutrition, weight loss nutrition, fitness technology in general, and kind of everything in between that with a little bit of mindset sprinkled in. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. The first 20 minutes, you're going to notice a huge sound shift, because the first 20 minutes, the sound quality is pretty good. And then for whatever reason, we cut, because we're doing this over Skype because Andy is in Fullerton in the US. And after 20 minutes, we knocked off the recording, went straight back into it, and then the sound quality is amazing. So after about 20 minutes, it's like, yeah, it's pretty good. And then from 20 minutes onwards, for the last 40 minutes, it's amazing sound quality. So yeah, I hope you enjoy today's episode with my guest, Dr. Andy Galpin. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am so excited to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Andy Galpin. Dr. Galpin is the creator of the Exercise Physiology Laboratory at CSU Fullerton, as well as their director of sports performance. His PhD is in human bioenergetics and his master's degree is in human movement science. He is also the co-author of book Unplugged, Evolve from Technology to Upgrade Your Fitness Performance and Consciousness, and his studies prove that most people don't fully understand the influence exercise habits, food consumption and technology usage have on their long-term health performance. Andy's Instagram page is one of my personal favorites, and his YouTube channel has some of the best videos on exercise physiology that you'll find anywhere on the internet. I'm so excited today to talk all things training, nutrition, and exercise physiology. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Wow, man, that was probably far too kind of you, but glad to be here.
I absolutely love your stuff, Andy. The way you put it across, your YouTube channel is an absolute game changer. Like, the stuff you put up on exercise physiology, I'm like, I can't believe this is on YouTube for free. It's just amazing.
Yeah, man, that's the goal. Honestly, I found myself in a weird position a few years ago where, you know, I'm in Cal State Fullerton and it's impacted. It's a difficult area. And what that basically means is it's hard for students to get into class. And I just kept thinking, yeah, this is really stupid that for some arbitrary reason, only 25 or 40 or 41 or whatever these weird numbers are, people get to be in here. But yet we have so many people that want this basic health and nutrition and exercise information. Why are we limiting it to people who just live in Fullerton, California and have the right registration number? It's just all this stuff, and it didn't make sense. So I was like, you know what? Like, I don't really care about, I hate business, no offense, but I hate things like that. And so I'm like, what I really want to do is just teach. And so, like, what's stopping me from doing that? What I do in class is putting it up on YouTube. And basically all of my friends said, that's a dumb idea, monetize it, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, I don't really care about that part. So I just put it up there. And, the response has been honestly pretty shocking. I feel really humbled that the people, the way that you, I guess, describe it is pretty universal to how people respond to it. So I guess something went right. I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Between the consumption that I've used myself and the amount of people I've sent to it, like, anytime anybody messages me about, you know, how do I learn more about training or exercise physiology, I'm like, well, firstly, go look at Andy's YouTube. I was like, and if you want more nutrition, go check out the podcast and anything that he's done. So it's brilliant. Tell everybody listening, Andy, a little bit about what you do kind of day to day, a little bit of your background, and what's kind of put you on your current path of kind of effectively being one of the world's leading experts in physical human performance.
Well, I don't know about that last part, but my day-to-day job, I'm a full tenured professor at Cal State Fullerton. So I run the Center for Sport Performance. And so within that, we've got 7 laboratories. But really the goal and the mission of that entire center is to produce and disseminate research that enhances performance. Now, I like sport performance, actually, but we also take a bit of a broader approach to that. And in my opinion, of course, in the words of the famous founder of Nike, Bill Bowerman, that, you know, if you have a body, you're an athlete. And so really my goal is, look, if I can figure out how to enhance, maximize human performance, what you choose to then perform or how you choose to use that new ability and facility is up to you. And so, like, I see it really as just, again, improving the human condition. And this is why I've also partnered with, you know, many of the private companies and such that I have, is we all have the same ethos, which is to drive the human performance piece. And so, again, you can use that to just live better or to be better cricket player or rugby player or whatever you want to be. I don't really care. So my job is to do that. So I kind of have, I guess, my career split into three pieces. Piece number one is research and that end. And I study specifically muscle. So my laboratory within that center takes muscle biopsies, and we analyze, you know, performance, what makes muscle grow, shrink, die, repair, adapt, all that stuff from the cellular and molecular perspective, but not in response to obesity or disease. It's really the other end of the spectrum, which is maximizing human performance. So the research is one piece. Of course, I teach in the areas, the graduate areas of program design, strength conditioning principles, physiology, sports nutrition, things like that. And then I work directly with professional athletes. I actually have an athlete who's got a weigh-in tomorrow, an MMA fighter. I've got a world champion boxer fighting next week. I got Olympians in wrestling and things like this. So I work a lot on one-on-one case with professional athletes, mostly from combat sports, but a little Major League Baseball and some things like that. So I kind of do that. And then I guess the fourth job that I really do that I don't really even consider a job is, I guess you'd call it, scientific communicator. So I do a lot of podcasts and a lot of things like this in media to help get the word out of the information that we have, to help people do things better or if anything, to inspire them and motivate them to be more curious about physiology and science in general. So that's kind of how I describe what I do.
Yeah, I think that's a very effective way of putting it across. And the way that you communicate it and break it down, because some of the things you talk about are very complicated, but you that teacher is in you, where you're able to break down complicated ideas into digestible form. You mentioned research there, Andy. Is there any research at the minute that you're particularly excited about, or anything that you're kind of obsessed on, or you're mainly focused on, or any area in research that you're like, oh, keep an eye on this space?
Boy, I mean, I don't know how long you want to talk. We've probably got 12 different trials going on right now, some that have recently wrapped up. We did a study on epigenetic responses to strength training and trained people versus untrained people, and that is accepted and should be out. It's on PubMed, or no, it's not. It's accepted. It's ahead of press with JSCR, but it should be out soon. We are actually... we've got our first handful of participants starting what's called a time-restricted eating. So some folks call that intermittent fasting trial. But the difference is we're looking at that in young, well-trained folks trying to gain muscle mass. So we're seeing if a traditional eating protocol versus a 16-8, if you're familiar with that, we know what happens with that in terms of fat loss. But the question is, well, does that influence, does that improve, enhance, reduce, attenuate, or not, neither, your ability to gain muscle mass if you're young and well-trained. So that is something we are knee-deep in at the current moment. So, but we've got a ton of stuff going on.
That's really interesting. That's I follow that intermittent fasting protocol myself more for just, I quite like the way that it makes me feel, more so than a body compositional effect. This is a little bit early. I was going to talk about this later on, but I think it kind of segues in slightly. And I'm going to jump around today between training, nutrition, sports, gym, etc. But there's been a trend over here in Ireland and the UK for kind of a high fat diet approach for athletes. Because you mentioned intermittent fasting there, which kind of brings on to kind of fat adapted and potentially some keto style diets, what are your thoughts on high fat diets or keto style diets for athletes, particularly those in, say, glycolic or sprint based sports?
Yeah, so I think that context is key here. We have to define what you mean specifically by high fat diet, what phase of the training they're in, what phase of the career they're in, what their body composition goals are, what their personal preferences, and how they typically respond. So my blanket answer would be, I'm in favor of anything that works. objectively. I would never dismiss outright virtually any protocol that there. Having said that, I think in general, if you look across the literature, it would support that a full traditional ketogenic diet, say like an 80% fat, 70% fat or higher, for an athlete like that as a year-round protocol is going to be detrimental, most likely. So does that mean you can't use it in short spurts? No, certainly. But should that be the default that most athletes were recommending be on ketogenic diet if they're a hurler or something like that? No, I don't think so. And the evidence is pretty clear. The physiology is wrong, the biochemistry is wrong, and the science would support that as well.
This was something that, I'm not going to lie, I completely stole your lines from it on Instagram stories. I'll tag you from now on. When you mentioned fruit on a recent podcast you did, Impact Theory, you were speaking about fruit and how it shouldn't be demonized, which kind of falls on the opposite end of the spectrum to high-fat diets and keto diets. And I get asked quite a lot on my channels about, should I eat fruit? Are there too many sugars in fruit? Or some variation of that question. What are your thoughts when it comes to fruit in people's nutritional plans? And kind of, do you have separate opinions for the general population versus athletes? And what's kind of your thoughts on this? I loved your piece on this. And I just wanted to kind of bring it to my listeners for those who haven't heard it.
Yeah, sure. I'll try do my best to not let you down here. I don't remember exactly what I said in a previous one, but in general, there's major overlap between general population and athletes. Certainly, the caloric expenditure of an athlete is presumed to be higher, so in which case, caloric intake should be higher. A portion of that should come from carbohydrates. So really, my recommendation would be the same, but athletes, of course, get to eat more. I would think that for the most part, an athlete who's not using fruit to their advantage is probably not optimizing what they could do. In other words, the fancy way, I guess, of saying, yeah, it's probably a pretty good idea. Even for the general public, people have a poor understanding in several realms of fruit. So first of all, it's an absolute versus relative issue. So say, for example, look at berries, blueberry, blackberry, whatever, strawberry, whatever you want to do. People think, oh my gosh, they're high in sugar. They're actually incredibly low in sugar. If you look at how much sugar, quote unquote, is in a cup of berries, it's very, very, very small. It just happens to be there's a high percentage of the calories in the berries that are coming from sugar. And so that's what I mean when I'm saying, well, relatively speaking, as a percentage of its overall caloric intake, a high percentage or of its caloric mass, a high percentage of its calories come in the form of sugar. But the absolute amount of calories are so low that there's the total amount of sugar you intake is very, very, very low. Same thing for most fruits, actually, not just berries alone. Banana is the famous one. Everyone probably in this space will know, okay, a banana, you're probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 grams of carbohydrate. Well, if you're trying to follow, say, a ketogenic diet where you're limiting your carbohydrate intake to 50 total grams a day, well, that sounds like a high number, right? Oh, that's half my carbs right there. But if you're eating 350 grams of carbohydrate a day, 25 is, you know, it's not even a tenth of your thing. And so they're not really actually that high. And you compare that to, say, a cup of rice, which is now maybe 100 grams of carbohydrate. So they're really, really not that high. In addition, the carbohydrate form is very, very useful, particularly for people who are physically active. So understanding the differences between the type of sugar that are in those things and the role that sugar actually plays in the body, it's typically demonized. And this is probably even a separate issue. But in general, people have a very poor understanding of what sugar means. I rant and rave a lot. I get really fired up about this. But in my opinion, you don't get to have an opinion, a professional opinion in this conversation, unless you can explicitly show me in organic chemistry forms what sugar actually means. And I say that not to be an elitist, but because I hear so many people that talk about this from an authoritative position, and it's very clear they don't understand what sugar actually is. They don't know what that word means, and they're conflating multiple things like added processed sugar versus a natural sugar versus a starch versus a fiber. Like, what do you mean when you say sugar? And so that's where the conversation breaks down a lot. People really need to step back, watch my videos. I don't care. Watch anyone else's, or just read a chemistry book for the goddamn sake of it. Read Wikipedia. It's up there. Read anywhere and understand what we mean when we say sugar. And this would solve a lot of the fruit issues in the conversation, because that's where it fundamentally breaks down. We have to understand what fructose does, and the fact that, I mean, some people are aware that, okay, a huge percentage of fructose is going to go straight to the liver, and the liver will process that, and therefore people assume that means it will be it will ramp up de novo lipogenesis, the making of fat, and the fructose sent to the liver will then be stored as fat. And that's complete garbage, because if we understand basic physiology, if you reduce muscle glycogen, the sugar in your muscle, you're going to typically start taking glucose, or the sugar in your blood, from your blood to keep your muscle going. When you do that, you start to take glycogen from the liver. And so glycogen in the liver is the backup storage form, if you will, of energy. And so if you have done a decent amount of exercise and you have some reduction in liver glycogen, and then you consume fructose, well, that's the most direct way to restore liver glycogen. So it's not going to be turned into fat if you're in a caloric deficit or even caloric neutral. You're going to use that to replenish muscle glycogen. So for a performance athlete, this is really, really, really important, because in fact, not only do we have to worry about restoring muscle glycogen, but we have to restore liver glycogen as quickly as possible if you're going to perform multiple times. And so where this issue again gets further distracted is when we hear people speak from the conversation or from the endpoint of body composition or fat loss or maintenance. Well, that's an entirely different outcome that we're looking for than sport performance. And so while the typical goal of a fat loss individual is basically getting the minimal amount possible to not starve yourself and feel terrible, and I'm being a bit facetious in our purpose, for the athlete, it's exact opposite. You have to maximize recovery because we are typically, with the athletes I work with anyways, it's not uncommon for them to train 15 times a week or more. This means multiple training sessions a day. So I don't have 48 or 72 hours to restore the liver glycogen. I have maybe at best 24 hours. So it's the same thing from the bodybuilding or hypertrophy community. Well, it's like, well, we don't have to worry about restoring glycogen for 48 hours because you don't use the same muscle twice in a row. Well, sure, maybe if you're a bodybuilder, but in an athlete, you definitely do. And so again, this is what I mean when the conversation has to evolve and we're talking about, well, what's the outcome goal? What are we talking about? Somebody fat loss, somebody kind of just working out 3 days a week, an athlete training twice a day, 6 days a week. These all have different answers, but in general, all of these people are typically going to benefit from at least some fruit ingestion. And this is, we haven't even gotten the conversation about the other things that come in fruit. The fact that they're fairly high satiety, fiber, the antioxidants, phytochemicals, and other micronutrients, the storage container component of those things, the riboflavins, et cetera. So when you look at the entire package, I can keep going, but I hope I made that argument fairly convincing at this point enough to say, yeah, avoiding fruit because you think it has too much sugar is a very, very short-sighted approach to nutrition.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. Like that message on it, because it's, I know a lot of my community and the people that listen to this podcast are on the fence.
Yeah.
They're on the
Go
fence
ahead and respond
fruit.
To that, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like people are very much on the fence with things like fruit. I think that explains it perfectly. And I've even found myself since incorporating more fruit, particularly post-workout, like your recovery, you know, to maximize recovery, it's going to be very beneficial for an athlete. That kind of ties into the next thing I want to talk on. You had a great post on Instagram, I think it was last week, possibly the week before, on post-exercise nutrient timing, and how we were once told that it was critical to eat immediately after exercise, what was called the post-exercise window, and that the pendulum has swung, and now we're being told after training is unnecessary, not important, or quote-unquote bro science. As you mentioned on your page, you had a great video that followed up on this, the truth's actually not that complex. But can you expand a little bit on your thoughts on post-exercise nutrient timing in general? That may include fruit, different carbohydrates, etc. But just what are your thoughts on that post-exercise nutrient timing and the kind of misconceptions around that?
So the post-exercise nutrition piece is, in my opinion, been conflated as well, especially because of those people coming from the body composition aspect. So let me back up the story a bit. For years, we sort of came to this revelation that, hey, getting in protein immediately post-workout enhanced or even rather optimized the amount of muscle that you would build. And that's because you would have people come into the laboratory fasted and they would either get protein or not get protein. And the people that got protein, of course, had a bigger protein synthesis response. All right. And so then the culture was, okay, great. And we noticed that if people waited for more than 30 minutes, more than 60 minutes to consume that protein, that they had less of a response. And so then the field said, okay, the science says eat as soon as possible and don't wait more than 30 minutes
maybe 60 minutes at most to consume your protein or you'll have less gains. And that was great. And then the research started coming out and saying, if you give people protein all day or if they have it immediately post-exercise or not. And so the recommendation quickly shifted to, okay, it doesn't matter when you eat. Well, to me, that was a huge jump in logic because it's not all what the research said. The research said, for the sake of maximizing muscle growth, it doesn't matter when you consume your protein. But if you look at the carbohydrate literature, that answer has been the same since day one. It does matter a lot getting your carbohydrates in very close to post-exercise. Now, what people would say is, okay, well, it only matters if you're going to do something like train again, you know, 6 hours or 8 hours later or even 24 hours later. But that's super unrealistic. And in my mind, I've always been like, are you shitting me? That is extremely realistic for an athlete. And that's because the people writing these articles or these social media posts are again, almost only understanding the perspective of body composition. And just like we talked about with fruit, they're assuming, okay, I do my legs on Monday. I'm not going to do my legs again until Wednesday or Thursday. So fine for the average gym goer, but that's not how an athlete operates. And that's not how many people who were, say, you know, if I cycle 4 days a week or I run 5 days a week, that muscle is definitely being used again. And so people have conflated, again, one outcome of, say, maximizing hypertrophy and also one nutrient, in this case, protein. And so while it appears conflicting, again, I would say if you look at the breadth of the literature, it's actually fairly, fairly clear. And I have a video that goes into all this. I think it's one of my more recent ones. You can watch, but the answer, again, is basically clear here. Are we talking about carbohydrates? Are we talking about protein? Are we talking about fat loss, muscle gain, performance outcome? That's what determines it. And so I don't also, at this point, see any disadvantage to eating immediately post-workout or fairly close. There's no reason to wait. And so the pushback on this, I think, has pushed people in the wrong direction, which is almost like, oh, eating after exercise is stupid. No, it's not. Maybe it doesn't matter that you crush a 30-gram protein shake immediately post-workout, but that doesn't mean we should be telling people to avoid food or talking about how it's nonsense to eat close to post-training. So we have to consider other things as well, like lifestyle, when do they train? So in the laboratory, most of the research, again, people come in fasted, but that's not how most people train. Some people like to exercise in the morning, fasted, fine. That science is probably fairly applicable to them. Many people, though, train at lunch or in the evening after 2, 3, 4 meals. And so that's a very different scenario. The timing of your nutrients post-exercise, it's going to matter significantly for somebody who's coming into the exercise off a 16-hour fast or somebody who's had 4 meals already today. So we have to do a little bit better job of thinking through when we see research, when we see people talk about the practical implications, is we have to think about the actual applications in your life and how that's going to work for the athletes or clients you work with.
Do you have a best practice or something that you'd recommend for, say, somebody was coming to you and said, Andy, fat loss is the goal versus somebody performance? Do you have a best practice on, and I kind of know your answer to this because I know food variety, etc., but do you have a best practice in terms of have a whey protein shake directly after, have a meal, you know, 60 minutes after? It doesn't matter if fat loss is your goal. What's your kind of best practice, general rule that would apply for a lot of people, or at least is kind of a takeaway that people could use and apply straight away to their post-workout nutrition?
So I will do my best to give you a direct answer here, but the direct answer is still, it depends. So if fat loss is the goal, the total calorie intake throughout the day is the most important thing. So that being said, let's backtrack. Okay. So once we place mark total caloric intake, and then however you like your macronutrient split to be, that's the end goal. That's what we have to be. Second most important step, what does the athlete and individual prefer? Some people have a hard time eating immediately after a hard workout. They don't feel good. Others are ravenous. Okay, then that's a different answer. What are they doing tomorrow for their training? What's the rest of their day at work look like? So my point, I guess, being is since we know for the sake of fat loss, the timing is not super critical. There's not a performance outcome. So if their performance tomorrow when the gym is a little bit down, it doesn't really matter. You just have to accomplish work. So from there, then take in logistics and practical considerations and do what is going to enhance adherence the most with the individual. I still would prefer, all things equal, to have nutrients in and around the training. I think it enhances recovery. It lets them train again. They'll feel the best. They're going to probably want to train harder the next day because they'll have a better recovery. But I'm very soft on that because it really comes down to the practical aspect of the human's life. We still have to coach people, right? Even though we're running online businesses, these are real people. So, I mean, I will immediately default to, what do you like to do? What have you done in the past that has worked before? What have you done in the past that you didn't like? Okay, well, let's just do this. If they want to have a whey protein shake, fine. If they hate protein shakes and they want to eat chicken, fine. Those things, for the sake of an average gym goer, that's probably the stuff we worry about that matters relatively little compared to, are you happy? Are you feeling sustained? Are you feeling abundant? Are you feeling like you're thriving right now and you're not on like a restriction diet? Because those things don't tend to work as much. If you accomplish that, stuff doesn't really particularly matter. So that would be my best practice, is for somebody who's just has fat loss on the goal, whatever it takes to help them get into that hypocaloric state while feeling full and satiated and all that stuff. That's what I would default to.
Yeah, I
think so. Is that enough of a direct yet still wavering answer?
It's funny because one of the things I love so much about you and your content, Andy, is you are the it depends guy, and I love that because there's so much context needed. And I know sometimes when this podcast, my audience are used to the it depends, because I'm always like, it depends on the context. But I love, yeah, like, it's impossible to give a one size fits all answer without context. But I love how you're able to apply, you know, certain best practices, and you're always able to give opposite angles to where it applies differently in different scenarios. I actually, just as a side note, personally love that about the way you put information across, just to kind of give you a pat on the back on that side as well.
Thanks. I know a lot of times people are really annoyed by it, but I mean, like, when you ask me for my honest answer, that's my honest answer. Is, I mean, geez, yeah, I could see it working in a bunch of different ways. I don't know how in good faith you could answer that question any other way. Like, it doesn't make sense to me unless you're incredibly ignorant or you're incredibly selfish. I just don't understand. Like, if you don't have the empathy to see other situations, okay, fine. Or if you see them and just refuse that or ignore that and think, no, I want you to just do it this way because I like it better for me personally. Both of those answers are wrong. So I just don't understand how anything else ever gets across. I mean, I do, but it's typically, again, because people only assume one training outcome because that's what they do. They're a fat loss person or they're Keto Dave or whatever. It's just like, well, can they assume that's the outcome goal every single time? That's not the world I live in. It's not the world that most people do. So that's why I answer it that way.
I think that segues perfectly, which you can kind of go into any specific, either diet or training. But you obviously see so many misconceptions online, particularly through, I think, the Instagram world and that particular medium, because of just the way the content is put across. Is there any particular misconception that you see in training or diet that like really irks you with the knowledge that you have, or anything you're like, oh my God, if I see this kind of content again, this is just not true. Anything jump to mind when I say that?
I mean, geez, tons of stuff. I'll put it this way, though. I don't typically respond that way when I see content, because my gut reaction, it used to be that way. It was for a long time, and my instincts still are, but I try to very carefully think, okay, this person, let's say you, all right, let's just give you an example so I can be not use so many pronouns here. It can be more manageable. Okay, so Brian put up a post about intermittent fasting. You said you're into that. Okay, fantastic. And he talks about how he thinks it's a fantastic way and more people should do it. So my reaction could be one of two things. Reaction could be, one, this guy's a fucking idiot. He doesn't know what the research says. He clearly is misguided. This would never work for my professional fighter who's 6 weeks out from a 5-round title fight. Okay, well, that's a whole lot of assumptions I just made. And if I think about you and look at your profile, I could probably very quickly deduce, oh, that's more than likely not the thing he was talking about. He probably was not suggesting that it would work in that scenario. So then where's the conflict? I actually created that myself. I made 5 or 6 or 7 assumptions about what you're trying to say based on how I see my world. So now that, in my opinion, that's entirely my fault, not yours. I should, if you don't do it in your post, okay, fine, But I then should take the responsibility to go and look at your profile, look who your audience is, and be able to go, okay, Brian's probably talking about how his experience with 18 to 25-year-old average gym goers looking to lose a little bit of fat, gain some muscle. In his experience, he's found this works. Okay, fine. Now, I like it when content creators make that for you. So in other words, they say like, hey, for this outcome goal in this population, I have found this works fantastic. Most people don't. They just come out with these super blanket statements like, oh, keto's the way. We should all be on keto. Okay, fine. If they don't, though, I take it upon myself the responsibility to go and look and say, who's this person really probably speaking to and for what outcome goal? And when you do that, you start to realize, oh, okay, well, yeah, this is another fat loss guy. Okay, fine. So intermittent fasting. All right. It's nothing special. It's not any different than not intermittent fasting for fat loss, but it is effective for people that follow it. So, okay. And when I see that, like, there's nowhere left for me to react. There's no more like, oh, that's a myth. Because it's their truth, and the level of what we'll call truth here is determined a lot by perspective. So it depends on what we're talking about and which thing we're looking at. And with social media, people just don't do a very good job of actually explaining or understanding personally their perspective in which they're speaking and who they're speaking to. So I generally don't jump with things like that. Good examples for me are people who are working with folks who have a lot of autoimmune disorders or things like that. I don't work with hardly any people like that. I don't work with anyone with eating disorders. Very specifically, I'm going to refer those people to specialists because that's not at all what I deal with. So if I was following somebody whose whole jam, like their whole Instagram page, was really centered on eating disorder stuff, and they said something about how intermittent fasting is really, really, really stupid, well, from their truth, it probably is. For the most part, intermittent fasting is something that's typically a very big problem for people with eating disorders. We do not want to encourage that behavior, typically. And so for them, like that's not a terrible thing. That's not really a myth. That's actually probably a fairly true statement, given that that's their audience and that's what they're really centered a lot about. So I hope that kind of makes sense to where there's just a few things where I see that I'm like, this is a total myth. It's more like, yeah, you need to put that in better context. That's not true as a blanket statement. You need to be more, you need to be softer on that. And so that can happen. And of course there are some people that will make extremely exaggerated blanket statements, but these are either people who, they don't have any value to me. So it's kind of like the professional equivalent of them saying like, you're a poo-poo head. Like, why would I get mad at that? Like, you know what I mean? That's not a real insult. So it doesn't even rile me up at all. So I'm just like, all right, moving on. There's enough of you. I'm not going to give you any of my energy because we'll go on there. I think that people in my position do have a bit of a responsibility to protect people against extremely predatory sales things. But outside of that, I'm like, well, man, if you're like intermittent fasting Brian or you're keto Dave and you want to put your whole identity to an eating style, I think it's silly, but whatever, man, like you do you. It just doesn't really jack me up. So I guess the only way to really answer your question is to say, the absolutisms, the identity of, I guess maybe I'll say it this way. There's a difference between what I'll call problem identifiers and solution providers. Okay, so the solution provider is someone who has a fairly high level a skill in an actual solution. So in the worlds of nutrition, it is, you're a keto guy. You're a gut microbiome fixer. You're an intermittent fasting expert. You're this. Okay. So your expertise is not tied in fixing a problem. Your expertise is a solution, right? But you're probably then not very good at identifying, well, who needs that actual solution? Because in your opinion, in your mind, every single problem has the exact same solution, which is your expertise. Right. So if you're a mechanic and you specialize in transmissions, every single car that comes into you, you're going to be like, well, it needs a new transmission because that's all you see. You are just world class in that specialization. A problem identifier is someone who can come in and say, the problem you're having here is actually the tires. So I'm not going to send you to the transmission guy. I'm going to send you to a tire expert. And so in my opinion, we need both of these people in the world, because if I identify an athlete or a client who for whatever reason, I think, hey, you know what? Actually, intermittent fasting is probably a really good idea for you. I'm not going to take on that responsibility because I'm not an expert in intermittent fasting. I will then turn and find somebody like, hey, you know what? I know this guy, Brian. He's really fantastic. He's exceptional in this area. Let's bring him on board to do this because he doesn't know how to optimize, say, your high-carb diet, but he's fantastic at executing intermittent fasting for athletes. Let's bring him on board. So, like, to me, when I see people on it, like, I'm usually thinking about that category. Like, oh, okay, this person is really – they don't understand it maybe, but they are really actually really good in autoimmune disorders for endurance runners. Cool. So I'm not going to trust everything they say for my professional fighters, but I know that if I come up with a situation where that is the problem I'm having, I'm going to go to that person. So I don't know. Again, another long-winded answer that kind of got off rails, but that's kind of how I view the internet and content.
No, I love that. I think of the old proverb, to the man with the hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. That's always kind of, it's exactly how I think about intermittent fasting, vegan, keto. When any blanket statement, you know, is something, as I said, it's one of the reasons I love your content so much is because it's nearly always prefaced with, it depends. You know, anybody that gives you a blanket statement that this is the only way, you should probably avoid them like the plague. If we're sticking to Bible references, like, it's not going to help.
Yeah, most definitely. So, I mean, honestly, if I'm being totally realistic with you, if anyone can't create content too much like that, they're just not a part of my world. So like, I don't really pay attention to them.
You mentioned something there that, again, it wasn't what I was going to cover, but the mindset side of things is something that really interests me. And you mentioned before that there was a time when you would get either annoyed or fired up or angry at seeing something that, you know, was completely irrelevant and you're like, that's not true. What did you do to get from that point to where you are now, where you're way more objective and nearly taking extreme ownership of the fact that, right, I've made assumptions that person is saying it this way. I'm curious, how did you go from, you know, point A to point Z or point A to point B in that? Because I know there's a lot of people listening, myself included, where in the past, there'd be a time when you'd see something you disagreed with and your instant reaction is to go and attack it. What was your process to kind of go the other way where you're more objective about it now when you're able to pull it back on yourself?
Three things, probably. Number one, just maturity. That always helps. Two, being faced with being wrong a lot. So humility. When you see scenarios and you think, oh, I know the answer to all this stuff. Well, eventually you're going to encounter a lot of scenarios where your answer doesn't work anymore. And then what are you going to do? And so there's a humility that actually comes with execution. So when you start working with individuals and you start actually collecting research on your own and you're running these experiments and it's not coming out the way that you thought, you can either have one of two reactions to that. Number one is, blaming other people, lying, faking, making stuff up, refusing to do stuff. Or number two, you accept the fact that maybe you don't know everything. So as you progress further on your career and you start failing more, you start opening up and reducing that arrogance. It's the classic Dunning-Kruger, right, effect. So the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know. So I think just as a natural progression to learning more things, you start to realize and open up with humility. And then the third, I think, would be you mentioned Jocko's book. It's a fantastic way to look at life. You get the gist of it, or just Google what that means, and as well as just a growth versus abundance versus scarcity mindset. All of those people that have done that fantastic work in those areas, I think those are really captivating, and you can start to take responsibility for everything, which is something I was fortunate to just grow up with. Everyone in my childhood and the place I lived had that basic ethos. So once you start applying that to other aspects of your life, it makes all of it a lot easier to execute. So it's a combination, like I said, of all those things. It's failing, it's maturity, and then it's trying to take more responsibility when things fail, the basic assumption being that it is your fault. Not in a self-deprecating way, not in a, like, you're so pathetic, you're stupid, you're no good. Just more of like a fantastic, hey, great, this didn't work, and it's my fault. Like, to me, that's always been inspirational, because if it's my fault, then I can totally fix it. The frustrating part in my life is if it's something goes wrong and you don't have the opportunity to fix it. There's nothing you could have done. So I find it empowering when it's like, okay, this didn't go well. I screwed up this recommendation or whatever. It's my fault. I need to go learn more. There must be something I don't know. One of the tricks that I give people is what I call the rule of three. So whenever you're encountered with a scenario where something is either doesn't seem right or goes against you, or in other words, whenever you think somebody else fucked up, we'll put it that way, you're allowed to have that feeling. That's totally fine. That's one. But in order, before you can accept that and delve into that feeling, you have to come up with two alternative scenarios. So one of them can be your fault. One of them has to be the other person's fault. And then one can be whatever you want. When you take the time to do that, and I'll give the example of you walk into the gym and somebody left weights on all the barbells, right? Which is a big time no-no, right? It's like, put your shit away when you're done. So reaction number one would be like, God damn it. I've told these people timeless times, blah, blah, blah. And this whole chain of reaction goes down. And then of course, so then you see them again, or you scream at them, or you send them a harassing email, you chew them out, and your employees, we told you to clean this up, blah, 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 big fight, aggression. So that's one reaction you get to have. That would be their fault. But one of them has to be your fault. So maybe you gave them poor instructions. Maybe you gave them a workload that was completely unfeasible. Maybe you put restrictions on them where they're supposed to be out of the building by 7 o'clock and the last client stayed there until 7:15. So now they didn't know what to do, kick the client out or clean up. But then they're not allowed to stay after 7. Like, so it could also 100% be your fault. Maybe the directions were not clear. The other one could be something like, well, maybe the person was violently ill, just trying to get through the day, didn't want to call in sick, worked their complete ass off, and just couldn't get to that. They were thrown out. Like you can imagine 100 different scenarios. And so that act of creativity and empathy, I think, is really, really important. Once you go through all of those things, then you can still come back and say, you know what? They're just being lazy. They're not listening to me. And you can send that hateful email if you'd like. But typically you're not going to, because in my life, I've almost always found it's very, very rarely that first scenario, which is a correct one. It's almost always people have a good reason. And so when you do that as a general practice, it changes, in my opinion, it changes your worldview quite a bit. And you would also, I think, well, I don't think it's very clear, the interactions that you'll have with people will be completely changed. So imagine the scenario of this. If you approach that differently, you're saying like, hey, I noticed the stuff was left out again last night. How did I mess this up? What did I do wrong that we couldn't get this stuff put away? And you'd be surprised how many times something where all of a sudden the other person now just relaxes. They're not in defense mode. They're not in like hyper excuse mode. They're all, and one of two things happens. They typically go, oh my gosh. So this client was here super late. I didn't know what to do. And you go, oh, okay, great. And now you just saved yourself huge embarrassment. You saved yourself an apology. You completely de-escalated the situation when it actually wasn't their fault. Or when it is their fault, they're so much more likely to just go, you know what? Fuck, I'm sorry. I got distracted. I fucked up. I didn't do it. I'm sorry. I was trying to get out of here. And either way, now that person is much more likely to be like, man, like I just keep screwing up. This is on me. That rule of three is what I say, like how helped me get better at this is I always think about that. And so whether I'm talking about like an interaction online with an athlete, how I handle my one-year-old daughter, if my dogs are misbehaving, like all those interactions, I always do the same thing. Like it's the three, you know, it's the three scenarios that I'll create with before I'm allowed to respond. So that's kind of how I do it.
I love that. I think what, you know, that rule of three, like straight away when you do that, it removes like the emotional sting of the situation, because it's not like, fuck that person for doing this again. You're like, you're like just way more moving towards a rational state. And that's going to help, like that's going to compound massively over time, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You mentioned your one-year-old there, and one of the things I've heard you talk about is challenging your sleep. I'm curious on this because I have quite a lot of, well, I won't say quite a lot, but there's a percentage of new parents that listen to this podcast. Some are athletes, some are gym goers, and sleep is like a luxury at a certain point. Can you talk a little bit about your own sleep in general at the minute and just your idea of challenging your sleep in general?
It's been what I would classify as extremely poor for a year and a half now. So like it's been really, really tough. It's still something we prioritize. It just doesn't happen. So for various reasons, we had issues. The kid sleeps pretty good now, but we just had all kinds of things that were very much out of our control that we just had to deal with it. So including things like my wife had a very rough pregnancy. And so that threw things off quite a bit. And then some other health issues that Munchkin had earlier in her life. So, in general, I think people are, I would agree with most of the research that people are mildly but chronically sleep deprived. And that's a problem. So prior to the kid coming along, our sleep was fantastic. I'm very good at that stuff and I really prioritize it, but it's been a bit of a struggle. So you have to just get through it. The world still moves. So I'm actually pro, I think what you're referring to is, I am pro sleep deprivation in context. So I actually think it's probably not the worst thing ever for people to go through short, intense bouts of sleep restriction, but only under a couple of situations. Those bouts are indeed short. And so I said this on a podcast and I had a bunch of blowback. Everyone's like, oh my God, you're so behind on the research. You can't pay back sleep debt. And I'm like, sure you can. So you're telling me that if you're sleep deprived one day of your life, you can literally never pay that back. Well, obviously you can. So what the sleep deprivation research shows is if you can't go like 5 days of sleep deprivation, in other words, you can't sleep 5 hours a night for the week and then think you're going to make it up on sleep by sleeping in Saturday and Sunday. That's what the research shows. And I'm not for that at all. Again, I'm not for chronic mild sleep deprivation. That's a terribly stupid idea. But if you are in a position where you can control and regulate your sleep pretty well, right, and you're sleeping on average 8-9 hours or whatever it is, at roughly the same time going to sleep and waking up most days of the week, I think it's probably good for you to once a quarter or something go through some pretty extreme sleep deprivation for one or two nights. But on the back end, then you need to fill that back in. So let's imagine that you went for 3 hours of sleep for three nights in a row or two nights in a row. Well, then you're going to repay that and say, okay, over the next 3 weeks, I'm going to commit to being in my bed with electronics, et cetera, off for 10 hours a night for the next 3 weeks straight. That's really what I'm referring to. So I'm not saying like, well, okay, sleep in the next 3 days. No, I'm saying commit to being in for long periods of time to really restore that sleep. And the reason I like the sleep deprivation is it makes that sleep payback a lot easier to do once you've come off a couple of days of being really, really under the gun. So that's really what I'm referring to with that. I do not advocate people doing what I have been subjected to the last year and a half, which is mild to at some point severe sleep restriction for extended periods of time with nothing you can do about it. So that's not a good thing.
Yeah, no, I remember my daughter's 4 now. I remember those days only too well. And it felt like the ultimate luxury. It's funny, I had it was just by chance, last week's podcast guest was Nick Little-Hales, who worked with the athlete Cristiano Ronaldo on his sleep. And he was speaking about paying it back, about overall cycles throughout the week. And he spoke about something very, very similar. So interesting hearing you say it as well. Just they piggyback off one another in consecutive episodes.
He was saying he does the same thing.
Yeah, he said it depends on the person, obviously. You know, again, one of the reasons I love Nick as well is it depends guy. But he was speaking about making sure that you get the overall amount of REM cycles, sleep throughout the week. So if you miss it, you know, you're doing 3 hours one night, 3 hours another night, that you're making it up several days later so that you're getting a certain amount of REM cycles per week as opposed to 8 consecutive hours every single night.
Yeah. I think that I would advocate to be as consistent as you possibly can. But you can repay back some sleep debt, but you can't, again, repay like sleeping super inconsistently all the time and then sleeping in 1 or 2 days or even 3 or 4 days, even a week, it's not going to help. You need a lot of payback, three weeks a month.
And it's randomization versus variation, as you'd say yourself with training, like doing it randomly is not a strategy. Variation is a strategy.
100%.
The last thing I want to touch on, Andy, is your book, Unplugged, that you co-authored with Brian McKenzie. Unplugged evolved from technology to upgrade your fitness, performance, and consciousness. And I'll be linking that in the show notes as well for everybody listening. Can you talk a little bit what led you to writing the book around this topic?
Yeah, I mean, it's Brian's idea for the most part. But when he approached me, you know, he was really fed up with people who were making too many training decisions based on things like heart rate and GPS trackers. And I'm not against those things. The book is not against those. I'm not anti-technology, certainly at all. But it was funny because at the same time he was complaining to me about it, I was actually having the same exact issues and having the same complaints. And that's what we would generally call outsourcing your intelligence or your physiology to technology. And I want people to be able to use technology to enhance performance, not to be slaves to the technology and not to circumvent that massive hardware and brain power you've got upstairs for a quote unquote smart technology. Because I promise you, there's not even anything remotely close to high functioning as what you already have in your brain. The trillion decisions you're making per second in your brain that you don't realize is a far higher number than what's going on in the iWatch that you have that's, you know, retailing for $300, but really it's $16 to create or whatever. So that's really what we wanted to do, is just to save people, say, hey, like, let's make sure we're not moving through this technological revolution and giving up our brain power and our computing when it comes to decision making for performance. Technologies have many benefits, but they also have many consequences. And I just wanted to remind people of both of those things. And so once you understand the pros and cons, you can deploy how you see fit to get the solutions you need, but not fall to the pitfalls of those. So that's really what Unplugged is about.
When you speak about the different technologies, and I'm sure you have lots of athletes that use different things, what ones are the most popular that jump to mind that you're like, that's probably slightly overused? Is it the fitness watches? Is it people with apps on their phone? Is there anything that jumps to mind that you're like, yes, it's beneficial, of course, technology can help, but it's probably a little bit overused? For example, I get people talking to me about, you know, Fitbits or Garmin's tracking steps, things along those lines, where you're like, yeah, okay, look at your nutrition, look at your overall training, etc. And yeah, your steps are important, but it's nearly, as you said, you're outsourcing your decisions to the technology. Anything that jumps to mind, app or device, when I say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, if you look at any of the watches, those are typically a problem. Sleep, HRV, these are the biggest offenders. If you work with athletes, GPS is a huge, huge, huge offender of all of these things. Again, all of them have potential benefit, but it's things like, if you look at the literature, number one, the accuracy is incredibly poor with any of these heart rate monitors, especially on the watch. Some of them are okay. Some of them are tremendously poor. Some of them, especially when you get to higher heart rates, lose accuracy. So then like, what, I don't really care if I'm at 120 beats per minute or 125, but I do care if I'm at 180 or 170. That's probably a big deal, right? If you're using it for that stuff. So number one, they're simply not accurate. For some people, actually, they cause a lot of detriment. And so what happens is you're supposed to get your 10,000 steps in a day. You got 7,000 today. It sends you a signal. Hey, basically, you're a lazy ass. That's the translation in your head. Tomorrow you get 6,000 in. You're a lazy ass again. Like, this is what's happening. You're being bombarded with failure. And you're being constantly reminded how much of a fuck up and failure you are. Now, for some people, it's motivating, and that's fine. I totally accept that. I'm not saying that it's not. I'm simply saying we have to recognize that for other people, it's demotivating. And so it's constant reminder of failure. And if you look at the literature, you'll actually see that this has happened in multiple clinical trials now where they give people things like this, and the groups that got the watches actually got fatter. And the hypothesis was that this is exactly what happened. They're just reminded of how fat, terrible shape they're in every day. And so they'd rather just ignore it, not do anything about it, because the mountain looks too high to climb. again, I'm not against the technologies. I'm simply saying we have to acknowledge that that happens as well. So we shouldn't be giving like recommendations like, oh, everyone should get this and we should track this and we should do this. It's oftentimes unmanageable. We can lead to poor decision-making because apps don't understand context. So there's another issue there, right? So if we look at this from the sake of an athlete, they don't understand what phase of training you're in. They don't know what you're training for. They don't understand the wind condition today. They don't understand that you didn't sleep last night because your one-year-old woke. Like, they don't understand any of these things. And so we shouldn't be making decisions based on a single metric like this that is missing the vast majority of the actual things that go into decision-making in our day-to-day lives. So, those are some of the and there's many, many more I could go on, but that's the basic gist of it.
Yeah, I think I couldn't agree more. As you said, for some people, it's brilliant, and for others, it's just not going to work. You know, I didn't think about that, but the psychological effect of your fuck up, like if you don't get your steps in, like that's so true. Like if you're being constantly reminded of that, that's going to go the other way. For some people, it's not. For some people, they're like, right, I need to get 13,000 steps tomorrow. I need to make it up. But it depends. Know yourself. Know thyself, personality type, and whether it'll work
or not. That's also an issue too, is you get people chasing the wrong metric. And so it's like, okay, I got 7,000 today. I got to make up 13,000 tomorrow. Why? It's like now your whole life tomorrow, the only thing you're focusing on is getting 3,000 more steps. And so what ends up happening is people focus on they give up their entire physical practice simply to satisfy a watch. And what the literature will show there is short-term motivation for gamification like that fails miserably. It's amazing for the first 6 weeks to 3 months. I mean, gamification is very clearly a good way for early motivation, but it's poor sustainability. An easy example is, do you remember Pokemon, the app for your phone, right?
Yeah.
Addicted the entire world, right? Everyone in the world was playing Pokemon. You know anyone who's playing Pokemon anymore? Nope, right? If it was that motivating, if it was that good, why aren't people still doing it? Because people love gamification for a few months and then they get bored of it. You have to change the game, right? And so the problem with trying to satisfy the watch is people will be very motivated and then we'll want to go to make sure they get their 10K in a day for a few months, and then they're not going to care anymore. The game is over, so we need a whole new game. Well, what that should tell you is that's a very short-sighted approach. We should not be using, if your entire reason you're exercising is to satisfy a number on a watch, that will be fine for a few months, and eventually you're not going to give a shit about the watch anymore. So now what happens to your physical practice? It's gone. So we should use that motivation to get you into a habit and a lifestyle that has a bigger purpose rather than the watch. If we can use it to bridge that gap, then the watch is successful, right? But that can't be the outcome goal. If that's the outcome goal, you're going to fail. And if you look at the literature, some people use a watch to get them motivated, they get started, and they continue their fitness journey for life. But the vast majority do not. Once they get tired of satisfying the watch, it's over. So these are some of the other problems with things like that. They're not really true motivators. We need to use that watch to say, okay, great, you're into the fitness. Now let's look at, pay attention. You notice how much better you feel. Did you notice your energy? Do you notice how your mood's better? You're thinking better. You're healthier. This is going down. Those are the things that people are going to be invested in because they care, not the watch. So the gamification puts the emphasis on the wrong thing with training.
Yeah, I think sustainability is the game. Like if it's not going to be sustainable and you're not going to be able to use that gamification process in 6, 12, 18, 24 months, regardless of what your goals are, even though the goals may slightly change, it's about what's sustainable and what can you do over the long term. Andy, as I mentioned, I can't thank you enough for your time, for the content you put out. For everybody listening, I'm going to link the videos that Andy was speaking about in the show notes. I'll also link the book Unplugged and all the website, Instagram, etc. But Andy, for everybody listening, where is the best place for them to follow you, or where's the best place for them to kind of connect with where you put out the most content?
Instagram is probably where most of my stuff goes. It's just Dr. Andy Galpin, so Dr. Andy Galpin. The YouTube channel, if you want to actually get the real deal, you know, the videos and stuff like that. Of course, I only put so much on Instagram. That's probably the best spot. There's not a whole lot on my website besides those videos. So you can go to the website, andygalpin.com, or the YouTube page. It's the same. basic thing. I have all these ideas of putting way more stuff up on the website and adding things, but I don't know if we'll actually ever get there. I got too much going on already. But so for now, that's all up.
Yeah, until the 1 year old is at least 10 or 11, priorities completely change. I know that feeling. Andy, thank you so much again.
One last thing, a little thing, actually, I get this a lot. You know, you guys know how you can't really link to things on Instagram. So if you're the type of person who wants direct links to the articles and the studies and things like that, those all go up on my Twitter. So I'm not going to change my damn link in my bio every time I put something up on Instagram. So if you want the actual links, you can go over there and get those stuff. But if you just want the gist of it and what my interpretation of it is, you can just stay on the old IG.
Awesome. 100%. I will link that as well. Andy, thank you so much again for your time. Thank you so much again for everything you do. This is freaking awesome.
Appreciate it, buddy. Have a good one.
So that is everything from today's episode. If you got this far, thank you so much for getting this far. You're a fucking legend. Like, people that get this far, I'm like, you're fucking legends. Anyways, if you enjoyed this episode, I will ask you to do one of two things, or possibly two things. If you really love me, do two things. First one is tag me on your Instagram story and be sure to tag Dr. Andy Galpin as well if you enjoyed this episode. And the other thing I'll ask for is if you're enjoying the podcast, wherever you are in the world, please leave a review on iTunes, particularly on iTunes, just because I can see the iTunes ones, but also on Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast. So if you're enjoying the podcast, if you're not enjoying the podcast, you're like, Brian, you're a dick, don't leave a review. I just be like, no, it's cool. But if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review. And I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Catch you all next week.